Hey everyone, I'm Thanos Davelis, and welcome back to The Greek Current, a podcast by the Hellenic American Leadership Council and Kathy Merini, where we highlight the top stories of the day every afternoon with analysis from guest experts, policymakers, journalists, and HELC staff. Over the last decade, we've seen the involvement of Turkey and the Gulf states grow significantly in the Horn of Africa, and the region became one more arena, like Libya and Tunisia, of competition between Turkey and Qatar on the one hand, and Egypt and the Gulf states on the other. While clashing interests and ideologies still shape dynamics in the Horn of Africa, President Biden's election has brought about a recalibration of Egyptian, Gulf, and Turkish policies toward the region. Expert Varsha Kodavayor joins The Greek Current to look at how this rivalry and the current detente between these countries has played out in the region and what steps the U.S. should take moving forward. Varsha Kodavayor is an analyst at Valens Global, a security research and analysis firm, and she has an expertise on the Gulf states and the region. She's also the co-author of the recent piece, Will Turkey's Détente with Egypt and the Gulf Extend to the Horn of Africa? Varsha, welcome to the Greek Current podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You write in your piece that the Horn constitutes one more area in which Erdogan and his Qatari partners seek to promote the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have worked actively to counter Turkey and Qatar. Can you talk about how this rivalry has played out over the years in the Horn of Africa?
So Gulf involvement in the Horn of Africa is not a new phenomenon. It's been going back for about 10 years. The roots of it are, I think, pretty visible. Like, there's a huge commercial sector here that can be to the Gulf's benefit. The Red Sea, Horn of Africa basin are obviously of geopolitical and geostrategic importance to the Gulf, given the transit points that they possess for maritime trade. And then there's also a lot of possibility for the Gulf states as middle powers and as regional powers to play an active role in this region. Where I think it started to get counter to U.S. interests and possibly even the region's interests is right after the GCC crisis broke out in June 2017, when the Qatar blockade began. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain cut ties with Qatar and enacted this land, sea, and air blockade against Qatar on the basis that Qatar supported terrorism. And this led to a geopolitical race in the Horn of Africa. We saw the Gulf essentially cleave into two competing axes. You had Qatar and Turkey, which Qatar had already had deep linkages with, and those linkages only became more strengthened as Qatar found itself isolated in the region. So you have Qatar and Turkey espousing this pro-Islamist Muslim Brotherhood ideological vision on one side. And then you had Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and also Egypt and Bahrain on the other side that embraced this anti-political Islam view. So the Sunni world cleaved in two, and the Horn of Africa really became the battleground for where these two ideological camps were staking out their rivalries, so to speak. So you saw Qatari-Turkish involvement really deepen in Somalia. To offset that, we saw Emirati and to a lesser extent Saudi involvement deepen in Somaliland. You saw Emirati involvement deepen in Ethiopia and in Eritrea and all across the region. It became, over the last few years, this battleground, as I had mentioned earlier, to win allies, to win commercial opportunities, and to flex their diplomatic muscles.
How have countries in the Horn of Africa reacted to the fact that they were becoming an arena in which Gulf power projection played out?
Not all Gulf engagement can be characterized as bad. I brought up Ethiopia and Eritrea for that specific reason. The UAE and Saudi Arabia were pivotal to mediating the diplomatic breakthrough that happened between Ethiopia and Eritrea after decades of conflict and fighting. That happened in 2018, and that was a result of Saudi Emirati involvement in it. But at other times and in other locations, the geopolitical competition has been incredibly damaging, and it's exacted a toll on the local population. I think one of the most telling, most maybe poignant examples of this was 2019. The New York Times obtained an audio recording that alleged that Qatar had had an interest in a bombing that a local ISIS, the local Islamic State affiliate, had carried out in Bosaso, Somalia. The recording implicated that Qatar possessed an interest in the bombing because it could drive out the Emiratis, who were also vying for commercial opportunities in Somalia. Qatar denied the allegations. As far as I know, the audio recording was not released. So this is one example, but again, like I said, a very poignant example of how the rivalry has borne out very tragic costs on the local population there.
Varsha, I'd like to look into Turkey's involvement in the region. Ankara's aid to Mogadishu has totaled more than $1 billion over the last decade, and Turkey's largest embassy ever built is also in Somalia. Turkey also maintains its biggest overseas military base in Mogadishu. What's behind Erdogan's interest in Somalia and the Horn of Africa?
So Turkey's involvement in Somalia goes back a decade. And this is a very interesting angle to look at. As you mentioned, Turkey has pumped in over $1 billion of aid to the country. You brought up their overseas base being in Mogadishu. They also have done a lot of commercial opportunities, a lot of commercial work in Somalia. I think this really goes back to the famine that Somalia suffered. And Erdogan took on the mantle of wanting to offer aid. It fit with this pan-Islamic view and leadership that he had molded for himself. So that's when Turkey's involvement in Somalia really began. But of course, as we've seen in the last several years, it may have began with humanitarian aims in mind. It may have began also with Erdogan thinking through some questions relating to his legacy and his personal beliefs, but it has devolved into a geopolitical and a geostrategic game.
How has President Biden's election brought about a recalibration of Egyptian, Gulf, and Turkish policies towards the Horn of Africa?
Joe Biden's election was, I think, a recalibration point for the U.S.-Gulf relationship, at least in the sense that it provided the opportunity for there to be a recalibration point. Joe Biden came into office with this overt focus on human rights. So he wanted to enshrine a human rights-led, a human rights-centered foreign policy after the last 4 years of a very transactional approach to the Gulf, in which many of our Gulf partners were essentially given carte blanche for their bad behavior as long as they continued to fulfill and meet some U.S. requirements and some U.S. interests. So you have this recentering of values in foreign policy that happens with Joe Biden's election. But then you also have the backdrop of the trend of perceived U.S. retrenchment from the region. And this is not new. I would say that this is a trend that all of our Middle Eastern partners, especially our Gulf allies, have been contending with for the last several presidents, the last three presidents or so. So that's really the background against which I think we should assess the election of Joe Biden. There was this trend already underway of our Gulf allies questioning the U.S.'s long-term commitment and longer-term presence in the region. And then we went from transactionalism the last 4 years to now a very overt focus on values in U.S. foreign policy. So I think it did lead to a recalibration amongst, as you mentioned, our Egyptian, Gulf, and Turkish allies. I think especially as regards Egypt and the Gulf, you start to see them wanting to mend regional rifts. You saw the relative patching up of the Qatar crisis. I say relative, and I can expand upon that later, why I say relative. But you also start to see them, especially the UAE, you start to see them recalibrate their broader role towards the region. The UAE in particular, for the last decade, has become renowned for pursuing this sort of very adventuristic foreign policy. They have been implicated in support for the Libyan warlord Khalifa Haftar. They were supporting Sisi in Egypt in 2013 when the overthrow of the Morsi government happened. And they've been involved in the Horn, as we've discussed. The UAE, I think, is the most visible sort of recalibration we have seen as a result of Joe Biden's election. They have started to reassess some of their footprints in the region, and they've started to reassess the role that they play, becoming less adventuristic and more focused on the diplomatic side, more focused on mediating regional conflicts, more focused on shoring up commercial opportunities rather than pushing for a particular ideological subset. So that's a very long answer, but I would say that in general, what has happened, you've got in the foreground, Joe Biden's election. In the background, the notion, perceived or real, of U.S. retrenchment from the region. And in the middle, you have the Gulf states that are trying to figure out what this means for their role in the region, for the next 10, 20, 30 years, and how their behavior should be crafted and modeled in a way that redounds to their benefit.
On Tuesday, we saw reports that Qatari and Turkish officials attended an energy conference in Dubai. Reports have called this the latest sign of the improving relations between the UAE and two of its foremost rivals. Do you think we'll see more substantial steps taken from each side to mend relations? And what does this mean not only for the Gulf region, but also for Libya, Tunisia, and the Horn of Africa?
Right. So this is why I said that there has been a relative patching up within the GCC, because this is not the first time that there has been an intra-Gulf rivalry that exploded. It was certainly the most serious expression of rivalries exploding. In 2014, too, there was a GCC crisis. At that time, it was considered the worst GCC crisis to date. But then it was patched up within a few months or so. That wasn't to say that the underlying tensions ever really went away. Those same underlying tensions, which is namely Qatar's support for political Islamist movements, Qatar's alleged support for terrorist groups, and allegations of Qatar being involved in terror and illicit finance to these groups. They were the same tensions that resulted in the June 2017 blockade of Qatar. Ultimately, the blockade failed. None of the goals of the blockade were exacted. The blockading quartet started with the 13 points demand list to Qatar, which Qatar rejected, which then was reformulated into a six principles list. The status of Qatar's adherence to those six principles remains somewhat unclear. And Qatar was able to withstand the economic pain of the blockade because of its deepening linkages with Turkey and its diversification of geopolitical allies and geopolitical partners in the region, generally speaking. So the question remains, how lasting is this détente and is this rapprochement? I certainly think that we will see more steps taken, like the attendance of this energy conference. We will see more of these sort of exchanges, these visits, these maybe confidence-building measures, if we can call it that, being taken. But the degree to which underlying tensions are resolved, that remains very unclear and up in the air to me. Hopefully, though, this rapprochement will mean less of a carving up of the region, as we've seen in the last few years, into competing ideological and geopolitical blocks. And instead, the Gulf can work on a focus that leads towards shared prosperity and shared security for the region. But like I mentioned earlier, the GCC has got into spats before, and none of those issues were ever really resolved. So this rapprochement could just be further papering over of the cracks.
To wrap up, let's look at this from the U.S. perspective. What opportunities does this relative détente between Turkey and Qatar on one side and Egypt and the other Gulf states on the other provide for the United States? What steps do you think Washington should take moving forward to prevent the kind of violent rivalry that proved disastrous in Syria and Libya?
Well, theoretically, this rapprochement should provide breathing space for the United States to articulate and push for a policy that can be to the region's benefit and can also help U.S. interests in the region. Instead of being in a crisis management mode for the last few years, instead of having to just put out fires between our Gulf partners, put out fires in the region as a result of the intra-Gulf rivalries, this détente should theoretically give the opportunity to push for a more beneficial, broadly inclusive foreign policy. The U.S. has the ability and the opportunity to prioritize its security and commercial interests, but also push for its values here. The question is, can it do that? I think especially in the backdrop of what we saw happen with the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, a lot of our regional partners, not to mention the Horn states themselves, are likely questioning whether the U.S. has the diplomatic muscle necessary to implement and enforce this kind of policy. I think the appointment of U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn is a very positive step. It was a signal that the Biden administration gives this area its due strategic weight in U.S. foreign policy. But to answer your question of what steps, it will take, I think, very muscular diplomatic involvement, very proactive engagement with our allies and partners in this region in order to prevent the kind of violent rivalry that we saw happen in Syria and Libya. And is the U.S. currently equipped to undertake that kind of muscular involvement. Against the backdrop of Afghanistan, it remains a little unclear and unconvincing to me whether the appetite for that kind of involvement is there.
Varsha, thanks for joining us on The Greek Current. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Thanos. It's been a pleasure.
In other news, Greece's pandemic-battered economy will bounce back even more quickly than its government projects and could return to pre-crisis levels this year, according to Bank of Greece Governor Yannis Tournaras. Tournaras told Politico this week that the strong rebound, coupled with Athens' commitment to structural reforms, should pave the way for the European Central Bank to continue to buy Greek debt under its asset purchases even after it ends its Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, or PEPP. His comments come on the back of the government's recent upgrade of 2021 growth projections from 3.6% to 5.9% in what is set to be the strongest growth in two decades. Finally, PSECA and the Hellenic American Leadership Council expressed their disappointment on Wednesday with the recent events surrounding the unveiling of the Turkevi Center in New York. In their statement, Halk and PSECA noted their dismay at the presence of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and His Eminence Archbishop Epilophoros of America at the event, making it clear that both Guterres and Archbishop Epilophoros had prior knowledge that Turkish Cypriot leader Ersin Tatar was going to participate at the event as quote-unquote president of the illegal pseudo-state in the occupied north of Cyprus. They nonetheless chose to appear with him. In the meantime, Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis has canceled an upcoming meeting with Archbishop Epilophoros in New York City. That wraps up today's episode of The Greek Current. Thanks for tuning in.